Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, job growth ended 2018 on a powerful note, with the economy adding 312,000 new non-farm jobs in December. Unemployment rose to 3.9% as more people entered the job market, and the labor force participation rate increased to 63.1%. A broader measure of unemployment that includes discouraged workers and those holding part-time jobs for economic reasons held steady at 7.6%. Is the economy truly booming? What's going on beneath the surface? Next, French police have arrested a leader of the Yellow Vest movement for a second time in a clear sign that the government is following through on its threats to crack down on protests that have shaken France for the past 6 weeks. Eric Drouet, a 33-year-old truck driver, was charged with organizing an undeclared demonstration for planning to meet six colleagues outside of a McDonald's restaurant. He was earlier charged with carrying a wooden club, leading many in the media to speculate that he's being targeted for his political actions. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the economy. Job growth ended 2018 on a powerful note, with the economy adding 312,000 new non-farm jobs in December. Unemployment rose to 3.9% as more people entered the job market and the labor force participation rate increased to 63.1%, a broader measure of unemployment that includes discouraged workers and those workers holding part-time jobs for economic reasons held steady at 7.6%. Is the economy truly booming? What's going on beneath the surface? We're joined from New York by Richard Wolff. He's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Dr. Wolff, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I think this is an age-old question, but when you get numbers that are so disparate as these, it ceases to be a rhetorical question. Is the economy really booming, or are we in less great shape than we think and headed toward a recession?
Well, let's take a step back and talk about the interesting issue you raise. If you're a serious person in terms of understanding economics, you know that the economy, like the human body, like a society, like any complicated institution, has lots of ways of measuring how well it's doing. And you need to be open to the different measures. And then you need to do that very difficult thing, which is to face the reality that different messages give you different insights, different signals, different notions, and then you have to put them together to come up with some composite kind of understanding. If you don't do that, if you latch yourself onto one or another index or sign or measurement, you're going to bounce all over the place and misread the situation. So let me give an example about our economy right now. Over the last month or two, we have had gyrations in the stock market that have been extreme. We have seen a long-term decline in the value of stocks and bonds that was so severe in the last 2 or 3 months of 2018 that it wiped out the gains that had been achieved over the previous 9 or 10 months. So we have a sign from there that the economy is in trouble. Here's a second example. We saw that one of the most important high technology companies in the United States and indeed in the world, Apple, had to report very severe bad news about sales of iPhones and other equipment, had to reduce its expected rates of return, profits and revenues. That's another sign. We also see political uncertainty and turmoil as voters express extreme frustration with what's going on in the economy. And I don't just mean here in the United States, but we have the Yellow Vest movement in France, a historic demand for better economic realities than what contemporary capitalism affords. So those are a set of signs of trouble. Then you have other signs, such as, for example, today's run-up in the stock market, or other days when the market has gone up, or those numbers you refer to in the employment situation. Those are signs that employment is going up, but they have to be set up against all the other measures. And then you have to do what's very difficult. You have to make a judgment call about what the overall signs suggest. And I'm just doing that the way every serious economist does it. And my conclusion is this is an economy in extreme difficulty, as much difficulty as I have seen in a long time. It has a political leader, and you can't tell one day from the next what he's going to do. You have a political leader who is also willing to disrupt the world economy, as his tariff wars are now doing, in ways that may aggrandize him politically, but that cause all kinds of grief and trouble in the world economy. You have a slowing situation in both Europe and China. These are things that are profound, long-term, ramifying kinds of economic challenges. And frankly, 1 month's employment numbers, however good, are no way or no reason to step back and pretend that all those other signs are not telling us what indeed they are literally shouting at us.
I was surprised also that the Federal Reserve Board chairman came out yesterday and said that he recognizes the strength in the economy and he's going to try very hard to not raise interest rates anymore. Did he do that because interest rates don't need to be raised, or did he do that because he's been under such pressure from the president?
Well, it's not an either or, it's both. I mean, Mr. Powell has a very severe problem. He knows that in response to the crisis of 2008, the way the United States avoided having a worse economic downturn than we already did, literally having another Great Depression like the 1930s, was by flooding the economy with vast amounts of new money and by dropping interest rates literally to zero and in some cases to negatives in order to boost and stimulate the economy. And of course, the Federal Reserve knows that if you pump up the money supply way faster than the economy is producing goods and services, you have a potential for inflation. You don't necessarily have one, but the risk of that is very serious, and the ability of a government to slow that down once it gets underway is not at all clear. So he has to do something to correct for, to offset, to modify the dangerous inflationary potential, and that involves raising interest rates. The problem of doing that is it hurts everybody. It means you can't borrow to buy a car without paying high prices, or to buy a home, or to use your credit card, or to pay for your child's education, which is now a debt issue. So these are signs that the Federal Reserve is, if likely, going to raise interest rates. It's been doing it. That freaks out Mr. Trump, because if we're all going to be spending less money since we can't afford the borrowing at higher interest rates, it's not good for his reelection in 2020. And so he puts pressure on Mr. Powell. Here's the irony. The numbers released this morning that show employment doing okay and wages, at least at the lower end, rising a bit quicker than they did before, these are usually signs that would lead the Federal Reserve to be more likely to raise interest rates than otherwise. And yet the stock market is booming, even though the stock market has to worry that rising interest rates will cut back on an economy already endangered by other things. Bottom line, the crisscrossing of contradictory pressures on the American economy, on the president, and on the Federal Reserve means that they're all saying a variety of things, but the truth is nobody knows exactly how this is going to play out, and the predictions, if they're made with great confidence, should not be taken seriously.
That's the voice of Professor Richard Wolff. We're talking to Professor Wolff from New York City. He's an esteemed economist. He's a professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, essays on the global economic meltdown. Professor Wolf, first of all, I want to thank you for elucidating the different factors and the different ways to measure the economy and to do it in a way that I think those of us who are not economists, which would be 99.999% of the people on the planet, can actually understand it. And you mentioned that there were negatives. There was the gyration of the stock market, the deep losses in stock equities or the assets, the loss of wealth in the past few months, the problems that one of the biggest technology companies, Apple, was having when they had to report severe bad news. You also mentioned voters' extreme dissatisfaction as exemplified in some of the movements like the Yellow Vest movement in Europe, but there are other kinds of manifestations of that dissatisfaction left and right. You also talked about Donald Trump's policies, the trade war in particular, as having a destabilizing impact. And you also mentioned that Europe and China's markets are slowing. In other words, demand is slowing because people have less money or they're more worried about future money. They're buying fewer things. China's economy in particular, China's growth in the past few years has been largely stimulated by consumer demand. So if consumer mood sours or if consumers just have less money, that has a big impact. Of those different factors and recognizing, as you have so well put it, that we have to look at them in their totality and then balance it against the positive signs, like today's positive jobs report. If you look at all of those factors put in total, is there any in particular that would be catalytic, in other words, greater than the others? Is, for instance, Trump's policies, because he's the CEO of the American state and what the American state does, given its preponderance of power and economic sort of its economic role in the world, is that a dominant position? Or if Donald Trump wasn't here, if there was a mainstream, normal kind of a president like Obama, would we be facing the same challenges?
Well, I think it's a very good question. Let me answer it as follows. Bluntly put, I don't think Mr. Trump makes all that big a difference, neither good nor bad. I don't think presidents in general do. The global economy is much bigger as a phenomena than any government in it, even the powerful United States. And hence, I would be very hesitant to give him more importance. He plays a role, but that's really all that he or any president can. If I were to say, or to try to answer your question, what's the key thing to look at? I think the best guide we have is history. And the history of capitalism as an economic system over the last two or three centuries that it has become the global economic system we now live in, that history teaches a very clear lesson. In every country where capitalism has become the major dominant economy, there has been an economic downturn, sometimes called a recession, sometimes called a depression, sometimes called an economic crisis, a business cycle. We have lots of terms for this very recurring situation. That has happened every 4 to 7 years on the average, in every country, all the time. Now, that's an average, which means it doesn't have to be that each time, but on average, 4 to 7 years. Well, the last great downturn for capitalism was in the years 2008 and 2009. If you add 4 to 7 to those numbers, you know that now in 2019, we are already overdue by the average of the history of this system for another downturn, another period when suddenly millions of people are thrown out of work, companies cut back on their production. Demand falls, the supply of goods and services falls. The government is called upon to come in and rescue the system with monetary policy and fiscal policy. Is it possible that right now, unlike the last 300 years, we're going to sail blithely into another few years before the anvil gets hit with the hammer? Sure, it's possible. That's what average means. But it's not likely. It's not something that a smart person would bet on, and you can be very certain that corporations across the world are very aware of this pattern and are already hedging their bets, pulling back on their investments, worrying to one another. Nobody wants to get caught expanding production of whatever company, whatever business they're in at a moment when the demand for it is about to go into the toilet. So Mr. Larry Kudlow, the big advisor to Mr. Trump, likes to go on television and tell us that there's no recession in the offing. Well, if he ever read a history book, he would know that that is the most dangerous, ill-advised, and unsupportable proposition he could possibly make. It may make for good PR for a few weeks and months, but it doesn't address a system whose instability is as deeply embedded as ours is.
That's the voice of Professor Richard Wolff. We're talking about the positive report today about jobs numbers, a big improvement than greater than the expectations in terms of the number of people who are working or got jobs, and wages went up. Now, these numbers, too, will be adjusted. So next month, that number, which looks like 312,000 new jobs, might go down significantly. We don't know. But we're not trying to monitor things like this. We're trying to look at big picture. Now, Professor Wolff, you talked about inflation. And again, we're part of the reason we like to do these segments is to help us, the people who aren't economists, to understand basic economic terms and definitions, and to not do it in a dry way or a nonpartisan way. We are partisans. We are partisans of justice. We are partisans of people being able to live. Of course, when recessions come, people lose their jobs through no fault of their own, or 9 million families went into foreclosure, or 3 million lost their homes in the 2008 crisis, a crisis precipitated in housing and then a financial meltdown. Again, inflation is a different problem, and I want to try to understand why there hasn't been the kind of wave of inflation that one might expect if the U.S. government and its central bankers are pumping literally trillions of dollars of additional currency into the system that doesn't necessarily correlate to an increase in the production of goods or services equal to the amount of currency. That would mean more dollars in the economy than goods and services that have been produced. You would think, thus, that there would be inflation, that the prices of goods would go up because the currency would essentially lose some of its value in relationship to the amount of goods and services produced. If I'm just looking at Wikipedia, in economics, inflation is a sustained increase in the general price level of goods and services in an economy over a period of time. A chief measure of price inflation is the inflation rate. Help us understand that phenomena and why, contrary to some expectations, it hasn't sort of roared back with all of this quantitative easing.
Okay, good question, and a simple, straightforward answer. If all of the extra money pumped into the economy to cope with the crash of capitalism in 2008 and 2009, if all of that extra money had in fact gone into the pockets of businesses and individuals who used it to buy goods and services, we would have had a sustained increase in the prices of goods and services, because no way did the quantity of those goods and services increase as fast as the money was pumped in. But that didn't happen. And the explanation is really quite simple. For the mass of individuals, they didn't get their hands on that money because that money was not given to individuals. It could have been. The government could have pumped up the money in the form of putting it in the pockets of poor people, middle-income people, in a host of different ways. They chose not to do that. What they did was to pump the money into the hands of the biggest banks, most of whom were effectively bankrupt at the end of 2008 and into 2009, into the hands of difficult bankrupt corporations. For example, General Motors got itself $50 billion worth of government money, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happened, and here's the answer to your question, is all of that money concentrated in the hands of corporations and the wealthy who sit at the top of the corporate pyramid, that money was not invested in producing more goods and services because people didn't have the money to buy them. They were not willing to borrow the way they had in the years before, because that's what got them into trouble and helped cause the crash in 2008. So what they did instead with all the extra money, and this is crucial, was use the money to begin to go into the stock market. We have had an inflation in the stock market. The prices of stocks have gone nuts as people used the cheap money that you could borrow for next to nothing when the government was literally pouring it in at the top, was used by people at the top to buy shares of stock from one another. The top 10% own 80% of the stocks in the United States. So what we've actually seen is the inflation concentrated in a stock market, making the rich become much richer as the prices of all stocks went up, since everybody in the world of big money was buying them from one another in a kind of gambling casino mentality. And that's part of why the stock market is an important sign and why the volatility now is so significant. Because the people who played that game, who enjoyed the ride up as all this money went into the stock market, are the ones who are acutely aware of what could happen to collapse all of that once the money either is withdrawn, which the Federal Reserve can do, or the money believes it's not smart anymore to stay in the stock market. We've had the nice inflation there. It's time to get out. If you have that as a general belief, it's one of those prophecies that brings itself to be, and then everybody running away from the stock market gets you the kind of extreme volatility and downdrafts we've seen in the last few weeks. So think of it as an inflation that was not general because it was concentrated in the stock market, because only the richest people had the money that the government was pumping in, and they played in the stock market as rich people like to do. And the rest of us kept wondering why the so-called recovery everybody talked about didn't seem to affect those of us, the vast majority, who either have no shares of stock or have so few that it doesn't affect the basic way we live.
That's the voice of Richard Wolff. Professor Richard Wolff joins us from New York. He's a professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts, Amherst, the founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. In order to read more about Richard Wolff and his writings, to find out about his books, go to his website, rdwolff, that's WOLFF.net. Professor Wolff, inflation in the stock market, and I can remember actually having a discussion a couple months after Obama became president in early 2009 with some friends, and we were making jokes. None of us had any money, but we were making jokes. We could buy like Citibank stock because it was like a dollar.
Right.
The stock market at that time was 6,600, I think. That was March 2009. That's when it hit bottom. Now it's at like, right now it's down, you know, today it's up, but yesterday it was down. It's in the 23,500 to 24,000 range. It was even higher, 25,000. That would be an increase of 400 times, a fourfold increase in stock value in the last 8 years. Really, truly inflationary.
Absolutely. There's where all the money came from the government into the hands of people who play the stock market, who have significant holdings, and who began to use that money, which they could borrow at almost zero interest rate, to buy shares in the hope of selling them to me 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years later. They did that. As the prices then went up, as others got in on the game, everybody could see, oh, this is a way to make money. It was much easier to make money buying and selling stocks than taking the very risky decision of hiring a lot of people and building another factory to produce output that you could not know whether people would have the funds to buy. So what you had was a shift of the economy more and more towards stock markets. It was an enormous gift of government policy that really enriched the 10% who have significant holdings of shares. And so it was a recovery for the rich, the ones who needed it least, the ones who had the most responsibility for bringing the crash of 2008 and 2009, are the ones who really got recovery, who got bailed out by vast gifts of incredibly and historically unprecedented cheap government money. Now, that's a very nice story. It typically lasts for 5 to 10 years, which is what it's done now. And then typically, when everybody realizes that the rise in the price of shares is not matched by any underlying economic growth that's comparable, then the anxiety begins. Oh my goodness, I don't want to get stuck holding inflated shares if they're going to be yanked back down by an underlying economy that isn't so good. And that's what's beginning to shake the confidence. And when that gets going, as it has begun to do in the last 2 or 3 months, nothing that Mr. Trump can or cannot do is going to make very much of a difference in that story. And that's true for the Federal Reserve as well. And so they dither and they debate and they snipe at each other. But the underlying mechanisms, which are given by the history of this system, make it the reasonable bet that we are in for a rough couple of years as all of these extreme responses to the crash of 2008 and 2009 play themselves out. I wish it weren't so, but the reality is we're barely out of the last crash of capitalism, 2008 or 2009, when we're on the cusp of the next one, brought in large part out by what we had to do to avoid the last one being even worse than it was. This is a system that isn't working for the majority of the people, which is why those folks in France, the overwhelming majority of their people, are either out in the streets with their yellow vests or giving polling results that indicate 70 to 80% of the French people support what's going on in their streets.
Richard Wolff is our guest. Richard Wolff, we have about 2 minutes left, maybe 2.5 at the max. When we hear about socialism and capitalism, one, we hear in popular Western literature, socialism is a system where the government runs the economy. Capitalism is the free market. What you're describing is that the government forcefully intervened in and directed the economy and directed it in such a way so as to benefit the already rich. And that was the basis for the stabilization of the system when it was melting down. That was through quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. Does the Federal Reserve and the government have the same tools available for the next recession, given the fact that this has been such a phenomenally, I don't know what you would say, a beneficent government when it gives money to the banks and to the corporations? Can they do it once again if we're faced with a similar kind of recession?
Well, the honest answer is time will tell us whether they can or not. It's clear that they will have more difficulty. For example, the interest rates are already so low, you can't lower them very much, and therefore that ability to stimulate by making loans cheaper is much limited when you're already at a 2% or 2.5% level, rather than the historically more normal 4, 5, 6% level, number one. Number two, we have been running enormous government budget deficits. So the ability to use deficit spending, which is another typical tool to cope with a downturn, that's a little more constrained because we already have an enormous national debt. The tax cut of last December makes that worse. So there are limits there. But I would argue that the biggest limit is political, ideological. The mass of the people are angry. That's why they voted for Mr. Trump in this country. That's why they voted in large numbers, surprising everybody, for Bernie Sanders. That's why the political middle around the world is disappearing and hollowing out as the extreme left and extreme right begin to have the support of people who know that something more basic has to be changed because the business as usual is simply unworkable. I think the toleration of the mass of people is going to be the biggest constraint on what the government does. And if I could add a word, the notion that the government is not a crucial part of all capitalisms is a fantasy. The government has always been crucial to the birth of capitalism and to every step along the way. It is a kind of magnificent fantasy to imagine an economy without the government.
Important point.
We don't trust one another enough. Otherwise, we don't let money be run by individuals or banks. We let the government control it because it is so crucial and it is too dangerous to do otherwise. That has to be faced sooner or later so we stop the empty debates about more or less government and really ask the question, who is the government serving and to what end?
That was the voice of Dr. Richard Wolff, who joined us from New York. He is a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown, and you can check out his work at www.rdwolff.net. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
French police have arrested a leader of the Yellow Vest movement for a second time in a clear sign that the government is following through on its threats to crack down on protests that have shaken France for the past 6 weeks. Eric Drouet, a 33-year-old truck driver, was charged with organizing an undeclared demonstration for planning to meet six colleagues outside of a McDonald's restaurant. He was earlier charged with carrying a wooden club, leading many in the media to speculate that he is being targeted for his political actions. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He's the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Welcome back, Gilbert.
Thank you for having me, you guys.
Gilbert, the French prime minister answered a reporter's question today. The question was, is there a political police in France? And he said, absolutely never. But this sure looks like this truck driver is being arrested for solely political reasons. What's your take on this?
Well, it's absolutely correct. Your assessment is correct. And as a matter of fact, some in the French media and political parties completely agree with that, specifically Jean-Luc Mélenchon of the France Insoumise. And I want to make a little note here. Jean-Luc Mélenchon and the France Insoumise was about 2 months ago subjected to police harassment.
Uh-huh.
100 cops showed up to his apartment in Paris at 7 o'clock in the morning, and not 100, but about 10, and others in the offices of the France Insoumise to seize computers, phone, etc., etc. So the thing is, yes, the Macron administration, unfortunately for them, are following the route of the repression, and they have done so even during the celebration of the New Year. In the New Year celebration, more than 150,000, I repeat, 150,000 cops, riot police, and military were mobilized all around France. Okay, just to put things in perspective, yes, there is some form of military police, political arrest in France going on, and it's kind of in the follow-up of the état d'urgence after the terrorist attack on November 1915. And the law had sort of kind of similar to the Patriot Act, and I think I actually talked about that on Sputnik at the time, similar to the Patriot Act in the U.S. are still in the book. About 4,000 people were arrested in prevention detention through the Gilets Jaunes movement, okay? And about 450 of them are still held, okay? So the crackdown option, I'll tell you, the crackdown option will not work. There's going to be, this Saturday, tomorrow, there's going to be Act number 8 of the Gilets Jaunes, and it's going to be nationwide. And also, unfortunately for the Macron administration, they've decided in a very, very stupid move to modify the help, the unemployment compensation, which will be shorter in time and less. So in France, you have about 10% of people unemployed. That's about 6 million people, and potentially that's, you know, a couple of million potential Gilets Jaunes. Now, what I want to say, the French public, the public opinion, is still not as much as it used to be, is still with the Gilets Jaunes. A new poll came out today, showing that 55% of French people support the Gilets Jaunes movement and want the Gilets Jaunes movement to continue. Now, that's very interesting. Now, Eric Drouet is a very charismatic guy. I mean, I'm going to mention something, you know, because I have to, just to give a background on his character. He's yes, indeed, a truck driver, but he's not the only one original leader of the movement, if I may say. There's also a lady by the name Priscilla Ludowski, who happens to be originally from Guadeloupe. And Drouet has been accused to be aligned with Le Pen as an anti-immigrant and so on, racist. Not at all. Priscilla Ludowski, again, is black and from the Guadeloupe.
Gilbert, let me just jump in. I want to help the audience really understand fully what you're saying here. That Eric Drouet, the truck driver, the 33-year-old charismatic truck driver, one of the two leaders of this movement. Of course, there are other levels of leadership, but he and the woman you're speaking of, it says a lot about the movement. He's a truck driver. He had his own, he started the Facebook page because he had his own grievances and problems. She, this black woman in France, was also, I believe she had a small cosmetic store or something like that. They were having problems, problems associated with the problems of many, many French people. They were not right. You know, some people in the Western media are presenting this as Yellow Vest is a Le Pen movement. This was from the grassroots. And now you have the French government arresting Eric Drouet for having an unauthorized demonstration because he wanted to, he lit some candles to in memory or sort of to salute those who had been injured by police repression. Then he went to a meeting at a McDonald's. He's arrested for an unauthorized demonstration. Now, I have to say, Gilbert, if that kind of repression was visited, obvious repression was visited upon somebody, say, who was leading an opposition movement in Russia or in China, this would be like major big news in the U.S. media that the Chinese government and the Russian government were cracking down on democratic dissent. But here in America, this is hardly a story, but it seems to me it should be top news.
Well, of course, it's hardly a story because the repression, you see, the repression of neoliberals like Macron by the so-called resistance against Trump in the U.S. is perfectly fine. You see, it's all a damn lie. It's all, you know, I mean, in the context of my book, The Orwellian Empire, this is completely Orwellian. I mean, the thing is, what Macron police state, because, you know, it has to be called that way, is doing is nothing different than somebody like Erdogan would be doing in Turkey. I mean, it is the same thing. But there is people, however, that are reporting it in France. And I want to give a kudos specifically to Le Média TV of Aude-Lanvin, to some extent Mediapart. You know, the mainstream media is on the side, just like in the U.S., just like elsewhere, on the side of the power and on the side of the corporation that control them. Therefore, they add their talking point, and the talking point is don't talk too much about the Gilets Jaunes, do not give them too much publicity, pretend that the mouvement s'essouffle, which means is completely out of breath, which is not true. I mean, I'll tell you, tomorrow there will be protests not only in Paris, but everywhere in France. Let me give you a list. Lyon, Bordeaux, Strasbourg, Besançon, Clermont-Ferrand, Nice, Toulouse, etc. I mean, this is not, the movement is not going away. As a matter of fact, it's expanding elsewhere. Those type of protests, more or less inspired by the Gilets Jaunes. Unfortunately, for this discourse in France and in the U.S. media, that implicitly this is under the control or instigated by Russia, it's complete nonsense.
Gilbert, I want to ask you about Mélenchon. You made the point that Mélenchon, who was the most left-wing, really left-wing socialist candidate, I mean genuinely socialist, not like the Socialist Party candidate, who did very well actually in the run-up to the final elections, in the national elections, his office too was raided in November, and Mélenchon, as I understand it, had to go kind of underground almost to avoid arrest. Is that correct?
Oh, no, no, Mélenchon didn't go underground. Mélenchon burst in his office. He pushed the cops around, and he was called by the mainstream media in France like he had blown a gasket. He did the right thing. He threw a fit. No, he wasn't arrested. They can't arrest him.
I thought I read some report that afterwards he was kind of unable to go to the office. He had to sort of work sort of in a different kind of way. Not true?
Yeah, it's true, but you see, I mean, it's kind of hard, you know. Mélenchon has a very, very interesting background. He's an agrégé de philosophie. He's a philosophy teacher, professor by background. I mean, he's not one of those énarques or sciences politiques. So he is completely different. Yeah, you're right. It's the real Mélenchon is the real left. France Insoumise is what the left should be and is. But I want to read a quote here of a note that Mélenchon wrote about Drouet. He wrote, "France's history is full of such people like Drouet who have marked a path like white stones." Okay? So it's, again, Drouet is sort of like, I'll tell you, I'll make another analogy, like I did in my piece about the comparing the gilets jaunes to the sans culottes. Danton, Georges Danton, before the 1799, nobody knew where he was. You know, he was a very small time lawyer, very, very poor aristocrat, and he came out of nowhere. And there's a lot of those people, like Camille Desmoulins, Saint-Just. And Drouet, as well as Priscilla Ludovsky, they're both very charismatic. And it's kind of a natural form of leadership. I mean, they're trying to say, the power is trying to say that Drouet is a putschist that wants to overthrow the French government through the far right and a bunch of conspiracy, really. And they will probably eventually we'll see the end of Vladimir Putin in all this, which is, again, pure disinformation, nonsense.
Gilbert, what does this do to Jouet? Does this make him a more important figure in French politics? Does it elevate his status? Does it get him in the news more? What is the public saying about him?
Well, the public have no issue with him. Of course, he's in the news because they his arrest. And this is the problem with power acting stupidly, like the Macron administration. They're panicking, and they're also sending mixed signals. You know, you have yesterday you had a minister of finance who said on France Inter that he was in favor of the referendum d'initiative citoyenne, RIC, and you have on the other hand someone else at the reunion of the cabinet today that said that they were going to enforce more radical method. Now, what is that supposed to mean? They basically used and all the radical method that they could. I mean, I want to say here for your listeners that the number of people that have died within the Gilets jaunes since the start, it's 11 people. And the number of injured, seriously injured, is absolutely enormous. And on another point, even Amnesty, and I'm not a huge fan of Amnesty International because they have their agenda, but Amnesty France have denounced repeatedly police violence in France. Now, they should take that in consideration.
I think we're out of time, John.
We are out of time. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. This is an important discussion that we'll certainly come back to. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again, this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve Tweets, at Left Eye Blog. And we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks.
Hi, everybody. Happy New Year.
Steve, there's a lot of good stuff. Why don't you start us off?
There is, but this being the new year, I thought I'd start with a rare moment of praise rather than condemnation for a headline. And this is a headline from the Washington Post, and the headline reads, Trump falsely claims Mexico is paying for wall, demands taxpayer money for wall ahead of meeting with Democrats. And this is so rare because the average headline over and over is what Trump says something ridiculous, and that's the headline. And you have to read down three or four paragraphs, and finally you get to the Democrats said something different or denied this was true or whatever. And here we have right in the headline, you know, Trump lying. And I give credit. And in their rebuttals, their proof that Trump was lying, they don't even have to resort to Democrats say, you know, it's just the Washington Post saying Trump's claims, like, for example, that there are 30 to 35 million undocumented immigrants in the United States are just false. So kudos to the Washington Post for that one.
Because we have a lot of headlines. Let's go quickly to the second one.
Which is the opposite. This is another Washington Post, and this was a fact check. And the headline reads, Trump's bizarre history lesson on the Soviet Union, Russia, and Afghanistan. And the entire ruling establishment in Washington is totally up in arms because Trump dared to say that the Russians were right, the Soviet Union, rather, were right to go into Afghanistan to defend the government there.
Wait a second. Can you read that, Steve? Read those words. Read what he actually said.
Trump said the reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there. So the terrorists going into Russia part is dubious. But here's the Washington Post fact check, who says there was ultimately a problem with extremism in Afghanistan, but it developed largely after the USSR left, and the Mujahideen groups that sprang up to fight the Soviets devolved into the Taliban. Well, in fact, the Mujahideen sprang up, quote unquote, to overthrow the socialist PDPA government, not to fight the Russians. And they sprang up in part because the U.S. was arming and funding and training them. And they were doing that before the Soviet troops were in Afghanistan at all. And this is not a disputed history. These are acknowledged facts. In fact, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on the show. So their fact-checking on Trump is completely wrong. It's completely eliminates an entire important part of history. That is that the U.S. lured by the Soviet Union into Afghanistan in very strong echoes of exactly what's been happening in Syria in the last few years, in fact.
I want to jump in here and repeat this because, in fact,
it's pretty amazing.
And it's not disputed. I mean, John, you know, you're a former CIA officer. When a socialist government took power through a coup d'etat in April 1978, the CIA and the Carter administration turned its sights towards Afghanistan.
Correct.
This was a year before the U.S. lost Iran because there was a revolution in Iran against the U.S. proxy government, the Shah.
Right.
So the CIA went in and supported figures like Osama bin Laden.
Well,
and other.
No, that's a very common misconception. Osama bin Laden wasn't in the area yet. He didn't go to Afghanistan until the CIA stopped providing material support. But what the CIA did in the immediate aftermath of the coup was to begin financing the Pakistani intelligence service and using the Pakistanis as a proxy against the Afghans and later against the Russians. And then once Reagan was elected president in 1980, by early 1981, Gus Stavrakatis, a legendary CIA officer, convinced the CIA leadership to allow him to supply Stinger missiles to those Mujahideen, many, many of whom later became members of the Taliban.
And Al-Qaeda.
And Al-Qaeda, beyond that. And it was with those Stinger missiles that they began killing large numbers of Soviet troops and Air Force personnel and turned around the situation in Afghanistan.
Well, almost immediately, the Mujahideen, who were supported by Western governments.
Correct.
I mean, whether the CIA was the specific agency at a particular moment.
Because remember, Soviet communism was supposed to have been the greatest, gravest threat to the West.
Yes. And those people, the Mujahideen, were called freedom fighters.
Right.
Dan Rather went there.
They were welcomed in the White House. They were welcomed in the Pentagon.
These are the same people who eventually evolved or devolved into Al-Qaeda, the same people who attacked the World Trade Center.
Yep.
The U.S., as long as they were fighting a socialist government or the Soviet Union or both, they were our friends.
Yep.
Our meaning the American government's friends.
We didn't like it so much when they went back to Cairo and killed Sadat. But so long as they were killing Russians, they were A-OK with us.
Yeah. And it's so unusual. I have to say what Trump said is so unusual because while he was not precise, the reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there. That's what Trump said. Even though that's not precise, what he's saying is the Soviet Union or the Soviet government was correct in fighting these forces.
Right.
Now, I've never heard any American political leader ever say that.
In fact, I'm looking at Haaretz right now, and they're saying that that statement specifically was so bizarre that it calls into question Donald Trump's mental health.
Yeah. But from my point of view, as a progressive anti-war person, as a socialist, I was actually looking favorably upon the Afghan government of 1978, not because I agreed with all of their policies or anything like that, but they were trying to bring basic reforms to a country that had been dominated by feudal practices. They were trying to have a minimum wage, the right to a trade unions, the right for girls to go to school, the right of women to go to school. And the people fighting them were assassinating the teachers who went to the countryside to educate girls.
Yeah.
Thousands of Afghan teachers in that Afghan literacy program from the socialist government were assassinated. The American government was supporting the assassins.
Yes.
I think what's so important here, and I'm so glad that we're having this discussion, really delving into this part of history. I wasn't alive during this time. I don't know much of the history of this, but when you actually take these lessons from the past, it is so helpful when you're analyzing what's going on currently, right? Like Syria, for example, looks very confusing from the outside until you start to look at some of the history of the region. And when you start to look at some of the U.S.'s history and you see that the U.S. has meddled, has intervened, has done so much bad stuff in all of these other countries.
And in the case of Syria, Steve Pat, the U.S. was supporting the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda rebranded, again, doing the same thing that they did in Afghanistan. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, was, is the verb there. Let's turn to a different story. Since you mentioned assassins, let's talk about a real assassination, and that was the assassination of the young Palestinian medic, Ruzan al-Najjar. This is the outrageous headline of the week from the New York Times. A day alive when a medic was killed in Gaza, was it an accident? And then the subhead says, when an Israeli soldier killed Ruzan al-Najjar, Palestinians called her an innocent martyr and Israel portrayed her as a threat. The truth is more complicated. No, the truth is not more complicated. And in fact, if you read the article, you can very clearly see that she was an innocent martyr and she was not a threat. So the Palestinians were correct. Israel was lying. And here's just to read one sentence from the article, or a couple sentences. The bullet that killed her, the Times found, was fired by an Israeli sniper into a crowd. Let me just stop that for a second. Israeli snipers don't just fire into a crowd. They fire at individual people. They have the best weapons American money can buy. So let me continue. It was fired by an Israeli sniper into a crowd that included white-coated medics in plain view. A detailed reconstruction shows that neither the medics nor anyone around them posed any apparent threat of violence to Israeli personnel, though Israel later admitted that should actually be claimed her killing was unintentional. The shooting appears to have been reckless at best and possibly a war crime. So absolutely, if you read this article, she was completely innocent. She was not a threat, nor was anyone around her. And the headline says, was it an accident? No. The correct headline is, when a medic was killed in Gaza, it was no accident. It was a war crime.
Don't we have international agreements where you don't kill medics?
Well, it's not an international agreement. It's a law.
It's an international law.
And here's the thing. I agree with you, Steve. This was by far the most disgusting article of any article in the New York Times during this time period. Why? Why did they do this vast amount of research to show equivalence, in a way, between the snipers of the Israeli government and the innocent medic who was assassinated? Why did they spend all of this time to say a day, a life, when a medic was killed in Gaza, was it an accident? And then the whole thing is like, it's like those news reports about when cops kill innocent kids in the black community. And then they go through the life of the victim and they find out, oh, oh, this medic, she was kind of, they describe her at one point as a self-promoter, that she lied about her medical expertise because she was actually going into hospitals to be a layperson learning medical practices so that she could practice. So in order to get into hospital, she had to say that she had more medical credentials than she actually had so that she could learn medicine and practice it in the field. And then they come and say, oh, it's more complex because she actually lied once about her medical. No, I mean, this whole article is designed to whitewash the Israeli assassins by not saying we're whitewashing you and she was guilty and you're innocent, but to create this cloud and this confusion, to throw sand in people's eyes. Why spend all of this money, New York Times, to do three reporters, an exhaustive study about a woman who was killed and shot in cold blood to show that it was more complex? I mean, disgusting. The worst article of the week. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's move on to a different subject. Back to is Russia. I don't think we've done Russia yet. This is a Washington Post. It wasn't an article. It was actually a video on the Washington Post website. And the title is, What a Loan to Le Pen. That's Marine Le Pen, the French right-wing politician. What a Loan to Le Pen tells us about Russian foreign influence campaigns. And the answer, as far as I could tell watching this video, is nothing. It tells us nothing. Here's the story. A colleague of Le Pen talked to a friend in the Russian Duma, the Russian parliament, who arranged a loan for her party, not for her personally, from a Russian bank. This Russian bank later went bankrupt and was taken to court by the Russian government. So it doesn't sound like this bank is actually, like, you know, in the favor of the government. And now here comes two sentences, one after the other, from this reporter who's presenting this report. What kind of conversations that member of the Russian parliament had with Putin or not, or with the Kremlin or not, we don't actually know. And here's the next sentence. This member of the Russian parliament used one of these Russian banks to offer money to Marine Le Pen's party, following that direction from the government that was, let's find ways to support far-right parties. He just admitted he doesn't even know if this person talked to anyone in the government. And then he says, he's following the direction of the government. I mean, this is just outrageous.
Steve Pat, 45 seconds. What's your last worst or misleading or funniest headline?
Let's end with this one. This is just a classic Fox News headline. I loved it. Socialism rising. Dems take house, pushing massive government expansion as party lurches left.
Aye. That is, we can see from what happened yesterday when the party just voted PAYGO, which is to adopt the Republican rule, that they won't really be spending any more money on social programs unless taking it away from other programs.
Calling them entitlements the whole time.
Yeah.
If this is socialism rising, well, maybe the good thing, Steve Pat, is when the Republicans called Obama a socialist for introducing the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people went and looked up socialism and a lot more people became socialists. So maybe that's the good part of
it. We're going to have to leave it there, guys, until next week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, that you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com and on Twitter at lefteyeblog. And we were joined in the studio by Nicole Russell. Nicole is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and also as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.